Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 10e épisode, conférence de Jeremy Weber, Negotiation and Democratic Decision Making.
Well, I too, like others, am absolutely delighted to be speaking at this conference in honor of your work, Jim. I've benefited from your generosity and your perspicacity for more than 25 years now, and it's just wonderful to be able to join with others in celebrating your work. So, thank you. I'm going to be speaking about a particular aspect of Jim's work that has puzzled me and that I've wrestled with. And that is the Jim's tendency, at least in Strange Multiplicity, and certainly in Public Philosophy in a New Key, to treat negotiation as the key master concept for understanding democratic processes. In one sense, it's trivial to say that negotiations are important to democratic decision-making. Of course, democratic processes involve a measure of negotiation, coalition building among people. But Jim is making a much stronger claim. It's not just that negotiations are essential to making democracy work, but that negotiations are the key normative concept in understanding how democracy should work. That seeing democracy as being primarily a matter of negotiations among groups is a step towards a better understanding of democracy. And I'll refer to this in my remarks as the strong claim with respect to negotiations and democracy. And that strong claim has long troubled me for reasons I'll make clear in a moment. At the very least, it has seemed to me that it must be incomplete. But more than that, it's actually not very easily combinable with other conceptions of democracy. It's not very easily combinable with processes of representative democracy, of voting, of hammering out a position through counting heads. It's actually not terribly well combinable, I don't think, with deliberative democracy, which tends to assume people deliberating together as part of a single political community. And it is difficult to see, in fact, how they should be combined. In fact, it's often seemed to me that the emphasis on negotiation as being the essence of democracy tends to displace the other processes for reasons I'll mention in a moment. And I think that sense of displacement also tends to feed a reading of Jim's work as being strongly anti-parliamentarist, against formal procedures of democracy. Indeed, Jim's work is often read that way. Many of the people in this room may well read it that way. And that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate both for reasons that have been expressed by several people already at this conference, and Charles Taylor expressed them last time. We need both. But also because I don't think that that is Jim's position. And it's certainly not his deep position, as Dominic, I think you were really on to. And it perhaps is not kind of entirely resolved, Jim, within your work, because you are dissatisfied with the constraints and the limitations of representative democracy. But you do recognize, in ways that Dominic drew attention to, the fact that both types of operation will have to be in effect. And it's also true of Jim's personal position on these issues. I've consistently been struck by the fact that Jim greatly admires people who are engaged in civic action and encourages his students to be engaged in civic action, but also greatly admires people who give their lives to engagement in formal processes of democracy and engage with those. So my remarks are going to be an attempt to think through the conundrum of Jim's strong claim about negotiations. And there's going to be three steps to my argument. First, why Jim's embrace of that strong claim I find troubling. Secondly, how Jim's claim might be easily adapted in order to be less troubling, but at the significant cost of much of its radical and generative potential. And that kind of easy adaptation is one that I've been tempted by, but I actually think would actually lose a great deal. I don't think we should adopt the easy, the deflationary solution that I'll suggest. What I want to do in the third section is talk about how the strong claim ought to be taken more fundamentally to heart, but understood as posing a more radical reinterpretation of some of our working assumptions about the nature of democracy. Negotiation is not just the mechanism of democratic interaction, but it actually points us towards a substantial reconception of other dimensions of democratic theory, and it really only makes sense within that more substantial reconception of aspects of democratic theory. Okay. Why is the strong claim troubling? Well, if understood straightforwardly, it has the following problems, it seems to me. First, it abandons democracy's mechanism for breaking ties, for majority determination. The whole reason for insisting upon negotiations in Jim's work is to prevent majority imposition, which is seen as being oppressive, especially in the context that Jim has been most concerned about, national minorities, indigenous peoples. But secondly, then, if it abandons democracy's mechanisms for breaking ties, if negotiations leading to agreement is the method of determination, how does one make decisions in the face of disagreement, of continuing disagreement? That's the virtue of elective versions of democracy. And if one can't make decisions in the face of disagreement, because one depends upon negotiations leading to agreement in order to legitimize political action, does one then fall into stasis when full agreement cannot be obtained? And does that in turn then mean that democratic agency becomes impossible, getting bogged down in a fruitless demand for consensus in every instance of democratic discussion and negotiation? And this, it seems to me, has implications for the recognition redistribution debate. Seems to me that two things have driven that debate. One is that the focus on recognition is a diversion of our focus from questions of redistribution. But I actually think more importantly, it's been driven by the concern that the attribution of mutual vetoes to different parties as a result of recognition claims end up debilitating the democratic process, which means that other major social projects that can't be achieved by consensus, like the redistribution of resources, therefore end up falling off the table, being driven off the table. And then the third thing that has troubled me a bit about the focus on negotiations is, doesn't the thinking about democracy in terms of negotiations as the primary concept require too all-encompassing, too unified a theory of groups? Negotiations as conventionally conceived really can only occur among groups, but how do those groups themselves make decisions? If majority rule is unavailable to them too, then action really ends up bogging down in a continual demand for consensus, unless the groups themselves are taken as being naturally unified and naturally coalescing around a particular identification of ends and weighing of ends. And so I've wondered from time to time whether Jim's position implicitly presumes that latter view of groups, a too unified, too consensus-oriented conception of groups. Okay, so those are the reasons that I found the strong claim troubling. But there may be an easy way to adapt those claims and that's what I'm about to sketch now. And that is to take the strong claim with respect to negotiations to be limited to particular kinds of disputes. Disputes that occur between groups in struggles over recognition, especially in negotiations with respect to the constitution of political communities. Now, there's some plausibility to that really being the focus of Jim's concern. Those kinds of issues have been the principal context in which Jim has developed the notion of negotiations as being central to democracy. He's tended to make the strong claim in the context of the claims of indigenous peoples or constitutional negotiations within the Canadian context. And struggles over recognition are the kinds of struggles with which he's been paradigmatically concerned. And so if struggles over recognition are seen as a subset of all political activity, maybe the negotiational model, the strong negotiational model, is appropriate to that subset of political action, but leaving open more majoritarian forms of decision-making with respect to other issues. But I don't think Jim would be at all happy if we ended up adopting that deflationary version of the claim. For one thing, Jim tends to conceive of struggles over recognition as being the heart of all political life. Secondly, he's manifestly concerned with more than just a constitutive moment or constitutive context. In fact, one of the most interesting aspects of Jim's work has been the extension of this conception of democracy to politics from below generally, right? where at least an exclusive reliance on formal procedures for decision making has been seen as being defective in much the same way that imperial government is defective. So, moreover, the deflationary reading of Jim's claims, I think, would domesticate his theory all too easily, robbing of its more radical and potentially fruitful challenge to our understanding of democracy, and most importantly, blinding us to the more extensive project of reconception in which Jim is engaged. And it's those possibilities, that broader reconception, that I now wish to sketch. And I should be clear that I'm going to take us through, I think, 5 moments of reconception that I think lie behind Jim's invocation of negotiations. But I should make clear that, in my view, these are all kind of projects that are explicit to differential degrees in Jim's work, and so in many ways are a call to further reflection and further action in all of us. Okay, so let me start with the suggestion that the strong claim with respect to negotiations presupposes a simplified and overly unified conception of the group. It's a mistake to treat Jim as arguing simply for negotiations among simply previously defined groups. In Jim's work, the groups themselves are in question, constantly in a process of recreation. He emphasizes the multiplicity of attachments that people have, the complexity of identities, so that individuals themselves participate in different groups, in different communities, and indeed that groups are formed over time and continually reformed through dialogical processes with other groups. So it seems to me that we have to understand the emphasis on groups that are implicit in the negotiation model in a somewhat different fashion. And there I think what Jim is doing is drawing our attention to the necessity of political agency proceeding from multiple collectivities. And from small collectivities, from national minorities, yes, but also from smaller collectivities, including those small collectivities that are essential to the notion of civic freedom that he articulates. He sees those as having their own integrity, as being mini collectivities, not merely coalitions of individual interests, having a certain intrinsic legitimacy, a certain self-authorizing capacity, not merely being created and controlled and defined by superior authority and by the room made created by superior authority. So his conception of groups is really important and really substantial, but not static. Secondly, his approach to negotiation involves a reconception of the presumed outcome that results from successful negotiations, or to put it another way, a reconception of what we mean by consent in political interaction. He does not mean full substantive agreement. Jim is very clear that it's unrealistic to make full substantive agreement as the standard of legitimacy in complex societies, that there will be continued disagreement. There will, at the end of a successful process, still very often be reasonable disagreement. And indeed, he says at one point that any outcome will be unjust. It'll necessarily oversimplify. It'll have to be open for renegotiation and reconsideration in the future. And so indeed, consent is reconceived so that it is seen as being a dynamic process of consent building. And he sketches the nature of that process. And we heard part of that in Jim's intervention in the panel this morning when he talked about the internal reflexivity of political communities. That he has, it is the kind of structuring a political community in terms that are dialogical, not monological. That where democratic action is seen as being non-definitive, or as he says at various points, the continual capacity for citizens to call into question the norms and to renegotiate the norms. And then the kind of standards of success are not full agreement, substantive agreement. That's often not attainable, but trust among the participants that they were heard and were engaged in the process, and a measure of mutual understanding. So consent is seen as a dynamic process, one that is continually being created. It's almost proceduralized, although not a fixed and canonical procedure. That gets to the kind of third kind of point. The institutional structures that serve to organize this process of continual consent building, the Constitution also needs to be subject to continual reevaluation and potential renegotiation. The institutional structure isn't rejected, the civil citizenship isn't rejected, but it always needs to be supplemented by, or even more, stimulated by civic action. This opens up, it seems to me, the possibility of embracing both the civic and the civil in a way that a simpler conception of negotiations leading to agreement doesn't involve. It means seeing them in relation to one another. And that, too, allows for action in the absence of full agreement, a possibility of there being provisional resolutions that are continually open to the potential for reconsideration and renegotiation. Now, I guess we need to do more thinking about what those procedures leading to interim agreements, provisional agreements, ought to look like. Jim is rightly very worried about how the parliamentarist solution to that can end up posing constraints and boundaries, becoming rigidified. And yet that seems to be, in some ways, the most obvious option on offer for how to engage in that decision-making in the absence of full-throated agreement. And in fact, so it seems to me that one of the things that most challenges us now is how we can capture that possibility of interim agreements, that of non-definitive solutions that are not fully agreed in the absence of a simple reliance on majority voting. But his position certainly points in that direction. And let me close by focusing on one last point. Note that if consent is reconceived in this way, one sees it as being the capacity to contest the existing norms and enter into their renegotiation, that consent no longer plays the foundational constitutive function that it's often taken to play. Not just in liberal theories that proceed from consent, but the role it's often assigned to it even in other theories that draw upon negotiations and agreement as the foundation for consent. For Jim, the outcomes of these processes are always provisional and partial, always dependent on the continued calling into question and potential renegotiation of whatever provisional solutions have been put into place. And for that process to work, there already has to be a community. The existence of community, of interaction in community, is already, in an important sense, presupposed by the reconception of consent that Jim is working with. So what does that community, that presupposed community, consist in? Well, Charles Taylor last night suggested, I think was pointing towards the same issue when he pointed to the issue of cohesion and whether that cohesion has to be founded in a measure of cultural cohesion, a measure of uniformity, or the ethnicization of a particular principle. That isn't a solution that Jim would embrace wholeheartedly, wanting to embrace the potential for more diverse communities that would tend to suggest. I strongly suspect that's the same for Charles Taylor. And the kind of positive sense of what that background community looks like, what it consists in, I think still needs to be teased out of Jim's work, still a project to be achieved. I think Jim points towards how he conceives of it when he talks about belonging developing through participation, that the actual process of engagement is itself a kind of part of the fabric of community, the generative of community. I think it has to have something to do with the fact that living and collaborating in community is seen as a value in itself, even without or even prior to there being agreement. But one thing is clear, and that is that limiting Jim's argument to negotiation and negotiation to constitutive processes only is itself wrong-headed for another and unexpected reason. Not only is Jim's invocation of negotiations not in fact confined to the constituent stage, but consent, as reconceived by Jim, is not sufficient for understanding the legitimate constitution of community. The kind of consensual processes that Jim is talking about contemplates, to some extent, presupposes the existence already of a political community. It does not found it. So all this means that Jim's invocation of negotiations really points towards a reconception of democracy that goes much further than simply seeing negotiations among groups as being the paradigmatic form of democracy. It points towards the value of complex nested, recursive processes of contestation and revision, which may include representative democracy, but that cannot be limited to it. And they presuppose a conception of social interaction and community that has value prior to consent. Thank you.